This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
Vegetables live in oppression, served on our tables each night. This killing of veggies is madness. I say we take up the fight.
Good day.
Guten Tag.
Dude. Welcome to I Read the News Today, oh boy.
Or IRTN for short.
That's Stephen Benedetti. He is a permanent resident in Munich, Germany, when he's there, where American where American liberalism would be center-right politics.
Yeah, my passport would sort of argue against the idea of me being a permanent resident here. And that's Matt Adams. If you can't tell from his accent or his attitude, he is both a Canadian and an American citizen, and there to talk to us this week about the news. We're back, Matt.
We're back. We're back for a moment in this set of occasional and rare podcasts. Today we're going to try to squeeze in a few things. We have to talk about the news out of Wisconsin with Walker. We have to talk about Obama and his proclamation for gay marriage and what's happening there, and around some issues around queer rights in Ontario. Then, speaking of rights, we got to talk about the crushing blow on rights in Quebec and the response in Canada, with a little bit of maybe throw in some crushing against rights in the U.S. It's all crushing all the time.
But before we do any of that, we're going to start off with our lovely feature, news you might have missed, news from below the fold.
So The Guardian broke a story recently by printing a, quote, confidential, unquote, nine-page memo urging conservative groups to use subversion to attack wind power. As Susan Glodenberg at The Guardian reports, and I'm quoting her at length here, the memo says, quote, suggests setting up dummy businesses to buy anti-wind billboards and creating a counterintelligence branch to track the wind energy industry. It also calls for spending $750,000 to create an organization with paid staff and tax-exempt status dedicated to building public opposition to state and federal government policies encouraging the wind energy industry, unquote. So this is clearly a smoking gun of astroturfing, promoting fake grassroots opposition via corporate interests. You too can read this nine-page confidential memo. You can find the link on our show notes.
If you can stomach it. As our regular listener knows, we here at IRTN have been following the disappearance of bees and the collapse of bee colonies for a few years now. Since our last podcast, a little bit ago, a couple of new things have come to light. First, as has been reported, the Monsanto Corporation and their genetically modified seeds and products have been repeatedly linked to the colony collapse disorder. And the leading company making these links is a firm called BeeLogix. BeeLogix's mission statement includes this. BeeLogix's mission is to become the guardian of bee health worldwide. Well, guess what? Monsanto bought them. Yep. Monsanto now owns the company that has been stating that Monsanto's products and policies are responsible for the disappearance of bees.
I think that's one of the most awesome stories I've ever heard.
I wonder if they'll buy IRTN, Matt. That could be good.
Sweet. Sellouts. So there's some trouble down on the farm, the Class 1 agricultural soil at East Bay, California, that is. See, the University of California at Berkeley owns this land, which means that it is, in name at least, public land. And the university is going to sell it for development. This is the last Class 1 agricultural soil in East Bay, California. And as Allison Hope Alcon reported on Civil Eats, on Earth Day this year, 200 people occupied the land and planted 2 acres of vegetables on the 10 acres that are there, including a children's garden, and they started offering workshops in sustainable agriculture and farming. Eventually, and we saw this coming, didn't we, riot police showed up, and the UCs filed charges against a large bunch of folks. So the bigger question here is, how do we protect farmland and support farmers as more and more farmland disappears to development? Something to chew on.
Yummy. As a rule, we here at IRTN don't like to link to the Huffington Post. Consider it an ethical stand on their business model. Today, however, I would like to make an exception. Back in May, I found a series of articles over there that we have put up in our show notes, and these articles point to what might be considered a trend. at least three large publicly owned corporations had their executive pay packages challenged or denied by their stockholders at their annual meetings. This is highly irregular. As a rule, the executives give themselves their pay and their bonuses. This pay is then rubber-stamped by a majority of large holding stockholders who are executives in other companies and who expect quid pro quo on their own pay at their own companies later. This time, however, at the annual meetings of UBS, at Bank of America, and at Gannett News Services, things didn't go so smoothly because the little folks, the people with 5 or 10 shares instead of 5,000 or 10,000, stood up and voted no, the way they should.
Rock on. As Africa Files reports, the Canadian government plans to cut approximately $380 million from its foreign aid budget, cuts that will have a significant impact on a number of African countries. At the same time, as NAPR reported, China, the world's second largest economy, continues to receive $30 million a year in aid from the Canadian International Development Agency. Pierre reports, quote, Oxfam Canada has echoed pleas from several African groups and unions for Canada to reconsider the cuts. They ask for Canada to unite with other countries to help raise the hundreds of millions of dollars necessary to ward off the impending famine in the Sahel Belt, unquote. So, cuts to famine areas in Africa is now Canada's legacy. Nice.
Canadians are known for being nice. So is an American living in Germany. I enjoy the lifestyle here. I especially enjoy what I consider to be the more leisurely aspects. You know, the 18 official vacation days, the 30 days of vacation, the endless beer festivals. Well, according to recent research, however, that is no longer true. Apparently, Germans don't know how to enjoy themselves anymore, and it's been getting worse since the economic downturn of 2008. I found the study interesting on a number of levels. One highlight is that Germans tend to be able to enjoy something more if they achieve something worthwhile first. That's a nice thought. Another highlight is an admission to a sort of jealousy towards other cultures, think Italy or Greece, that seem to like life a little more. They just have a general jealousy about that. If this same sort of study were conducted in the USA, I just don't believe that we would be so honest. Yet another thing, quite possibly holding Germans back from enjoying their lives to the fullest.
Well, and that's Below the Fold news you might have missed. From the last one there from Stephen, who is occasionally in Germany, but he's not traveling the world as an international spy.
Oh, sure. Go ahead and broadcast it. Thanks,
yep.
Matt.
Yep. Oh, we're going to bring out some deep, dark secret facts about Steven as we go on, I think. Let's start with, well, you know, this show, I think when I describe it, they'd always say it's about the upbeat. It's about the positive in life. It's about putting that smile on your face because there's never too many of those to go around.
And nothing says happiness and success and overall pleasantness than the elections held in Wisconsin yesterday.
That's right. So yesterday, you know, was the recall against Governor Walker, who had pushed through legislation attacking public unions and public workers and teachers, and Walker survived his recall quite handily. He won by almost 173,000 votes.
The big thing, you know, and I want to make sure that we're clear about this, in terms of the recall election and why people were so angry, it wasn't just the policies he implemented. It's that he didn't say he was going to implement those policies when he ran for office. It wasn't like he was following through on his platform. Like, nobody could accuse, for example, Obama of, oh my God, where'd this idea of health care for everybody come from? You never said you would do that. Of course, you know, that was his major platform thing, and then he followed through, and people were upset, but not because he lied. It's actually because he followed through. Walker never said he was going to do this.
Right, you're exactly right. And it became sort of this touchstone around, can this be the place where he will pay the price for overstepping? Or will this be a sign that governors across the country can take on public workers? And I think there's some good analysis coming out saying that neither of those things is necessarily true. You know, the vote was close. First of all, The turnout for young people who tended to support the recall was very low, only 16% between 18 and 29 years old voted, compared to 22% in 2008. Schools out, universities out, that makes it more difficult to get the youth vote out. The other thing is I think is very interesting is that I was reading today, 60% of voters thought that recall elections were only appropriate for official misconduct.
Right, 60%. And bad policy is not official misconduct, no matter how much it might anger you or how much you might think it's unfair. It is not misconduct. It is not bribery, corruption. It is not any of the things that so many other politicians have had to resign for.
Yeah, I mean, arguably some of his conversations when he thought he was talking to the Koch brothers, but I mean, there wasn't a quid pro quo conversation like I do this and you give me money. Then yes, that would have been a bribe or official misconduct. So people, I think, which is interesting in Wisconsin. Obama has a significant lead over Romney in Wisconsin. And so they're saying, the AP is reporting that Romney plans to really compete in the state and he wants to, Wisconsin is the top target. But a lot of people, because they didn't believe it was, they're not going to vote for Romney. And so that, I guess, is a little bit of, see, we're positive. That's a little silver lining here, I think.
Well, there's a second silver lining, too, in that it wasn't just the governor and the, is it, it's not vice governor, it's assistant governor, it's the second in command. They weren't the only ones on the ballot. There's also four senators or five state senators that were on the ballot, and I believe if I've read it correctly, they have lost control of the Republicans no longer control the Senate. It is now a one vote majority for the Democrats, where it was before the election started. It was a five vote before the first elections, it was five votes in favor of the Senate of the Republicans, and now It was even for the last little bit, and now the Democrats actually lead by one. So there's a little bit of a silver lining there, too.
Well, that's a good point because, though, to tell you the truth, I am embarrassed to say this. I forgot to look that up.
I believe the four senators that were being challenged all won, but the one race that was going for the empty seat of the person who had resigned went to a Democrat.
Right, yeah, there it is, took back the Senate. So that, in fact, was quite significant because now it can't just be these, you know, they just sort of rush them through and this legislation happens no matter what. There'll have to be some negotiations, some bargaining. And I don't pretend that somehow Obama is some great friend of labor, but certainly more so than these guys. So we just wanted to quickly get that off before we got onto other exciting
Obama
news.
At least believes that the labor board should, support the labor, the laborers. That he doesn't think they should all be, you know, captains of industry running the labor relations board. So
yeah.
There's a pretty significant difference between his position, no matter how much it might lack from our perspective, but still a significant difference between his position and the standard GOP position.
Well, and then maybe that's a good time to transition to where he's actually right for once.
Well, yeah, are you talking about evolution, Matt?
his
views
brilliant term
evolving?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a little bit, because it was early May when Obama made his affirmation of same-sex marriage, where his position evolved, quote-unquote, a term I'm sure that they had workshopped or researched.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I'm quite critical of the president in terms of how he hasn't followed through on some things and how he's to the right, and I'm going to do that later in the show, of even Bush. And I've been quite critical on this show of his support for gay rights because he said in his campaigns that he would support them, and I felt like he was doing it too slowly. So I feel like I need to say that hats off. He did the right thing, regardless of his motives, you know, whatever. He did the right thing, and it's actually, more important than necessarily people even understand.
When you say regardless of his motive, that's what's really interesting about the whole thing. Because when he came out and said this, the lash back or the backlash from the right was not nearly as severe as people were expecting, and I want, you know, us included, I think. And part of the criticism is they were saying, oh, he'll say anything to get elected, which basically is conceding the point that this is a popular and winning position, you know, which I think even 2 years ago, you would never have gotten the right to admit to that.
Oh, yeah. Like Glenn Greenwald, who was very critical of the president, wrote a nice piece in The Guardian about how this is actually an historical moment. And he pointed out that the British writer Andrew Sullivan published a book called Virtually Normal in 96, advocating legal recognition of marriages for same-sex couples. And he said very few people supported him, including gay groups. And he said he was actually picketed at bookstores by one gay group for it. Now, I actually understand some of that because there's a large number of, I mean, gay marriage is legal in Canada, but there are groups that say, well, it still sort of normalizes a single sort of family form. It doesn't recognize multiple family forms and different ways of people can organize love and organizations and groups. So, you know, multiple partners or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so people still think that it's confines within the state. I happen to think that it's actually equal protection under the law.
Right.
So we either believe in equal protection under the law or perhaps we don't. So,
right. And one of the okay, you're talking about the legal issues, and I'm talking about the political issues.
Yeah,
issues. And to me, I don't think the legal issues are all that interesting because for me, they're cut and dry. But I guess, you know, for other people, they aren't. But again, so back to the political issue, another thing that people were – they were saying that Obama waited so long and, you know, described his views as evolving and was hesitant to actually come out in favor of equality for gay marriage – was because he was afraid of losing the black vote, which is a Democratic bloc that is consistently against or has been consistently voting against the legalization of gay marriage.
Generally by age, though. But yes.
But overall, it's been a bloc they were worried he would lose some of his, I think he had like 96% of the black vote in 2008. They were worried that even if he lost 10% of that, it could be enough to swing a few states. But what's interesting is they're finding that his coming out in favor of gay marriage seems to actually be swinging the black attitude towards gay marriage. It's actually going the other way. He's a role model, oddly enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's polling that shows that at the African American communities, as a whole big swatch, tend to poll more critical of gay marriage than sort of the white groups as a whole swatch. But a lot of that breaks down by age and by religious affiliation. But yes, as you're saying, that's even shifting. And it's also interesting that the media doesn't talk about that Dick Cheney came out in support of gay marriage in 2004, running for
marriage. Let's personalize this. He came out in favor of his daughter's rights.
Yes, but he did support, yes, his daughter's, who's a lesbian. But nonetheless, that's, you know, so it's the Cheney position.
No, but in 2004, you say he came out with that while he was still vice president?
Yeah.
I thought it was after he stopped being vice president or president.
The Greenwald's claiming that that it was during re-election in 2004 because Obama's the first president to support it. While in office, and Dick Cheney was the first vice president supported while in office, but I don't think his support was nearly as unequivocal.
I don't think it was vocal. Yeah, I don't think it was vocal.
And
asked him, he would admit it. He would talk about it in quiet rooms.
And it is a tremendous. I mean, he's using the word evolution, which is very clever, not to say he changed his mind, that it evolved. Because who wants to say they didn't evolve, right? That they regress? It's a brilliant...
Well, I think there's a large block of Americans who would be very happy saying they haven't evolved.
Probably. But I thought it was brilliant in the sense that, because then he can say our culture has evolved. And I think that's certainly true in our lifetimes. We're in our 40s. And just sort of the radical change in thinking in the culture... and probably thinking in us personally, right? Just our own personal involvement about understanding our own prejudices and homophobia and whatever in our own lifetimes. I think we're
specifically when we were in college. Like, can you remember? Like, there were a few gay people at our school, and it was more or less you talked about like in hushed whispers. Oh, that guy's gay. I think, you know, I heard that guy's gay. We didn't make fun of them. We didn't. We didn't bully them, that's for sure, because we weren't the bully types. but it wasn't just an open thing, and that was not that long ago. And it was had some pretty liberal aspects, our college did, but liberal education.
Yeah, I remember someone asking me to wear a pink ribbon on my shirt for sort of supporting queer rights one day when I was a first-year student, which I did. But I just remember thinking, I'm going to get shit all day, right, for this. But I actually didn't, you know. But so I'm not, I'm, I wish at that time that I had more confidence in what I was doing, but I'm just saying that I don't, that would be a non-issue nowadays, right?
Right, yeah, like okay, as, pink, yeah, whatever.
As sort of we approach and challenge our own prejudices and privileges, and I think that, that it was important. I think the president, that's one of the things he can actually do. In a few minutes, we're going to get into some things that, that I'm furious with him about.
Yeah, and there was one really interesting thing I saw right before we started, and it said that since 2000 and, I want to say, 2004, like when they do polling, the number of people who say that they know gay people in their lives, you know, friends with, or know gay people, it's gone from like a little over 30% to over 60% of people now say that they know gay people. And that, of course, is going to make a difference in the way people vote and feel about issues like
sure,
that.
Sure, because they begin to see gay people as, what's the words, people. You know, like huh. That human beings with their foibles, my foibles, yeah. You have your foibles. Yeah, it doesn't mean I don't think there's a tremendous work to be done around homophobia and sexuality, but it was an important step. I mean, it was heard around the world, right? Heard around the world.
Yeah. I think it's some steps, you know, we take some steps forward and end up like then taking like small steps backwards. I don't see this one going backwards.
No, I think, no, I agree. I think it's largely an age thing. I think that, the polling shows that younger people, regardless of political affiliation, tend to support LGBT rights. And as the population gets older, and that's just going to continue. So people under 25, even self-identified conservatives, tend to just say, meh, you know, more yeah. libertarian view, go ahead, live and let live kind of thing, which is great. But let's talk about something that's...
Yeah, well, I was going to say, before we move on to our next point, let's just say one more time unequivocally that both you and I think the president actually did a very good job and a very good thing in a proper way in this issue. We don't have any reservations about it.
He did a fantastic thing, I think. And props where props are due. And I've been given a really hard time around this for the last few years. So my hat's off to the president on this particular issue. But
okay. What do you think about the president?
No, wait. I want to get connected to this really quickly in Canada.
Okay.
Let's talk really briefly about what's going on around gay rights in Ontario.
Oh yeah. Okay. This you sent me some information. You fed me a little information so I wouldn't come across as being completely ignorant in our podcast. And I read your stuff and I went, oh my god, I don't understand this at all. So you're gonna have to lead us through this, Matt.
Just really briefly, because I think it's worth talking about, is that these struggles continue everywhere and they never end. That in Ontario and in Canada in general, let's just talk about Ontario, for constitutional reasons, there are two public school systems where public tax dollars, as opposed to other tax dollars, go to support it. There's the English, there is the non-denominational...
Secular?
There's the secular, that's the word I'm after. There's secular school system. And then there is the Catholic school system. And within that, there's English and French happening. So public dollars go towards Catholic schools. And that is actually part of the – it's in the Constitution as this big compromise. So recently, as in like a day or two ago, the Premier of Ontario is mandating – they passed a law mandating that there can be anti-bullying clubs in schools, and the Catholic school board said they're okay with having anti-bullying clubs, but they didn't want any that were called gay straight alliances. Nothing the word gay in the name of the clubs, and the Ontario government said no, this is the way it's going to be. That in fact, there will be anti-homophobia clubs, and they will be called gay straight alliances. So, first of all, I want to say clearly that the president of the Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association, they said their members support this legislation because, as he said, it protects students from homophobia and other forms of discrimination. But the Toronto Catholic District School Board and some of the Catholic hierarchies strongly, strongly opposed, threatening all kinds of legal action. Campaign for Life says this legislation now puts a radical homosexual agenda in every publicly funded Catholic and public school across Ontario under the guise of bully prevention. They're calling on school boards to reject the legislation on grounds that it adversely impacts their faith and morals, Section 93 of the Constitution Act. So you have this battle around sort of religious expression and protection of civil rights. So in the United States, you can't have publicly funded Catholic school or any school, any religious school, but in Ontario, you can.
In Canada, you can, or in Ontario, you can. Do you know?
Both, but in some both. Provinces okay. have gotten rid of it, and it's, okay. it depends on the province. my view, of course, as a progressive American, is that you're all or none. Either every religion that has like more than five people gets publicly funded schools, or none of them do.
Okay, but that's your progressive Americanism, where in our Constitution in the First Amendment it says that the government shall make no law regarding religion, et cetera, et cetera. The Canadian Constitution does not have that.
Yeah,
correct?
Canadian Constitution actually explicitly allows for the Catholic school system, and that's where this tension arises, because they're saying, well,
right.
we don't want this. The leaders are saying that, the board's saying that, not the teachers' association, saying we don't want to promote something that our religion is opposed to, and the government is saying there's a higher thing here, and that's about sort of civil rights, and it's going to come down to implementation. But it's interesting that it's such a fight, that this is what they're fighting for, right? Like, I would like to think that the whole point is supporting the safety and security and learning and education of students, but their concern is the word gay.
Right. And you talked about how they're, and I really hate this term, the criticisms of this is the radical homosexual agenda. I hate that phrase. They use it again and again, but... the idea that this is some radical homosexual agenda being imposed on the students from above, as opposed to like the students saying we need to protect ourselves against the lacrosse players or whoever it is in Canadian schools. I doubt that it's football players. So I'm thinking Canada. I'm thinking lacrosse.
Hockey, dude. Hockey.
Really? Because hockey players are just so nice. anyway, it's I just picture it being. I can picture like some. Gay kids and straight kids saying, we need to band together. Hey, Mr. Teacher, will you help? Will you sponsor us in this alliance? I don't see it being imposed from above. So it's like they're stopping kids from trying to be who they are.
I know, and the irony, of course, that the Catholic Board is concerned that someone is trying to impose their views in some hierarchical way on young and impressionable minds. Around a belief system is needs
or
no more comment.
Or we could go a little even a little darker. Just that, the Catholic Church suddenly worried about gays, young gay people. It's never seemed to be a problem or concern of theirs before. They seem to kind of like it. I don't know.
My personal view is they should follow the teachings of Jesus around homosexuality.
Yeah, they should. They should quote him word for word and do everything he said to do.
Word in class.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, so that's just our little point about how the struggle never stops. And what I'm seeing now, it's going to be the longest show today. Speaking of struggle, as we move on and on and on, the Maple Spring.
Québécois. And do you know how it's pronounced? How is your French, Matt?
It's abysmal. I was born in New Jersey.
I didn't know that.
I took French in upstate New York, and then I did a term abroad in Switzerland. And then I tried to take a class here, and then there was a strike. I think my language abilities.
Was it the student sounds right?
No, it's not actually. I think I would need to be embedded in a community, like total immersion, and not even where I couldn't even cheat. I couldn't go to Montreal. It would be tough because you can use English in Montreal. I'd have to be like some part of northern Quebec or something and just really study. I can read it a little bit better and I can hear it a little better, but my pronunciation is horrible and I don't understand it, and especially the Quebecois accent or the Quebecois language.
So you can't pronounce the Maple Spring the way they do it as a pun on the two words?
No.
Okay, good. Anyway, so this is, and I wanted to start, again, you sent me some information saying this is something you definitely want to talk about, so I looked into it. But what's interesting is as I began reading about everything that's been going on in Quebec since, how long has this been going on, Matt?
About 50 days, something like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a good bit of time.
We should talk about what is happening, but go ahead.
But this is not made international news at all. This is there's no coverage of it here in Germany. I was looking through papers, after you sent me this stuff, trying to find anything on it. This is a local phenomenon. I started looking at American websites, looking going further down in the, you know, not below the fold, there's just nothing, man. This is a Canadian story. No matter how important it might be to you guys, it's isolated.
Which is very interesting, you know, because like the Wisconsin story was very important to people in Canada. People were buying the pizzas for people, and there's documentary about it, and everyone cared about it, and because it became this metaphor. And I know American politics gets much larger because there's more larger, it's a hegemonic state, it has lots of money and lots of people. But, you know, people have looked, especially Americans, have looked to Canada for civil rights issues. Gay marriage, single-payer tax,
healthcare,
Medicare, blah, 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 Social Security for years. And so I think what happens in Canada is actually quite important. So what's happening?
So what's happening? Yes, absolutely.
40, 50 days ago, the students in Quebec came out strongly striking against an increase in tuition. That was the sort of what they were officially protesting. And the protests kept going on and going on and going on. And so the government put through a bill, a law, now 78, to really restrict the rights of people to assemble. We can get more into that specifically. But those that law is so draconian that it resulted in a huge response from the people of Quebec and from people in Canada. That's the sort of really short thumbnail about what's going on. But what's important about this here is that it's a major crackdown on civil liberties by a government, and then the response across English and French-speaking Canadians has been a sort of rare solidarity.
Right, and that's another thing that as I was reading the background on this and learning about this, I don't think, again, non-Canadians are aware of just how much tension there is between the French-speaking community and the non-French-speaking community. It's pretty severe.
Yeah, I mean, there's tons and tons of history about that, and I need to learn more myself, but, you know, if you were born a Quebecois, a francophone in Quebec, and you were working in the 70s, you couldn't get jobs unless you spoke English, high-paying jobs. And so it was this, you know, things like that, right? That's where this whole sort of, you know, this movement of, you know, being allowed, like, people were losing their culture. They weren't allowed to basically speak their own language. And people weren't, you know, there's you know, centuries of struggle, obviously, between English and French peoples. But some of that is played out here. And so generally, people in Quebec argue that Canada is a series of nations. You know, we have an English-speaking nation, a French nation, and indigenous nations, and that these are sort of different solitudes, as they call it. And most progressives in Quebec would support an independence movement, and they so it would be more like they'd rather be a friendly neighbor, like with the U.S., than a but not don't want to speak on behalf of people, but that tends to be the position. So yes, a lot of tension.
Right, and I don't, like I said, and I just don't think that comes across so much to the outside, and even as I was reading some of the stuff about what's going on now in the casserole movement, that like one of the big surprises is the solidarity throughout the English speaking parts of Canada with what's going on in Quebec itself, and I think part of that reason is that the territorial governmental crackdown on liberties is something that people could see happening to themselves in their own territories throughout Canada, and so that's why they're trying to support it now.
I think there's something to that. Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of two things here that are happening. I think when students came out against tuition hikes, a lot of people say, well, they pay very little tuition and it's some of the lowest in the country, and why are they complaining? You know, but in fact what they were talking about is austerity movements that are happening by these governments across the world, and that things are getting worse and worse and worse and harder and harder and harder, and there's fewer jobs and incomes are going down and tuition is going up, and of course public schools are funded by all taxpayers, so as tuition goes up, that means more and more low-income people can't apply. And so this sort of protests that went out were really, in my view, about austerity and about governments continue to crack down despite all the evidence that these kinds of things don't work, and we can talk about that too. But
not only that, but it's like a better educated society is a better off society, period. There's been nothing ever to contradict that.
Right, so then you've got But, you know, and there's tons and tons of evidence. I mean, like, look at, I mean, that's what Stiglitz said. It was the president of the World Bank. He said, I kept waiting for people to bring him all the studies to show them that the stuff that the IMF and everybody else was doing is working. But if all these cuts, in fact, never worked. Though, like, for 45 to 90, the per capita in Europe grew way better than it did in the U.S., and they had a welfare larger, you know, like a third larger of a welfare state. Anyways,
Well, it's the old, you know, a rising tide raises all boats, right? It's you want the least well off people in your society to be doing as well as they can. It's the only way to measure success in society. You don't measure success by how well the top half of the best 1% are doing. They're always doing well. It doesn't really matter what else is going on.
Yeah, by definition.
You've got to look at how the other people are doing. And, you know, you don't judge ancient Rome or ancient Greece or ancient Egypt on how the pharaohs were living or the senators were living. You look at how the people in the streets were living.
Well, exactly.
That's what you look at.
And that's what the students were out saying. And then, you know, the protests kept going on and on and on. And some of the protests involved some vandalism, et cetera. But by far, that was a minority situation. And so the Quebec legislation passed a law saying any demonstration within 50 meters of a college or university, banned. 50 or more people must submit their intended route 8 hours in advance to cops.
Cops can change that route if they want.
They can change it if they want, and that's your. And we're talking huge fines, $1,000 to $5,000 for any individual that contravenes the law. Any organization, student leader, $35,000. If you're like a leader encouraging other people, unions or other organizations supporting these marches, $125,000 fines, up to $25,000 to $125,000. So this is an extreme crackdown. Likely unconstitutional. It's being challenged in the courts.
Well, I was about to ask you that. I mean, that's, and it's one of those, free speech, but you can't shout fire in a movie theater. We have freedom of assembly also in the United States, which theoretically is you know, unabridged, but you need permits to have parades and demonstrations. What about in Canadian? Is there a Canadian right to assembly in general?
Yeah, there is a Canadian right to assembly. You do need permits, but there is a right to assemble. It's going to be challenged. It is being challenged. So soon after this law passed, on the 100th day of the student strike, there was upwards to 250,000 people came out to intentionally thumb their nose at the law. And I think that really struck a chord with people across Canada in a lot of ways. And one thing that people were doing in Quebec was what they called, as you referenced, casserole protests. These actually started in Chile many years ago. First against Allende, when sort of middle-class women, I read about this, would march to the streets hitting their pots and pans to sort of complain about they couldn't get food. But it really was connected under Pinochet, who didn't allow people to go out and protest in groups. So at a certain hour every night, people in their own kitchens would just bang pots and pans. So they weren't violating the law. They were simply protesting. So that's what they started to do in Quebec and in Montreal. They're saying, all right, every night from 8 to 8:15, we're going to bang our pots and pans. And we're not breaking the law. And then people started going out into the streets, not just students, people from all kinds of different neighborhoods, all kinds of different walks of life, because they're like, we live in what's supposed to be a democracy. We're going to be allowed to talk to our neighbors. We're going to be allowed to walk in the streets, and we can protest if we damn well want to. And so then people...
50 people is, I mean, it might sound like a lot, but it's 50 people is really... I think we've had New Year's Eve parties with 50 people.
I know. And so then English-speaking Canadians in different cities across Canada started doing it. And in fact, tonight is supposed to be on June 6th, supposed to be one of the biggest sort of solidarity casserole protests, where people are going to go out across the country and sort of bang pots and pans and just sort of show solidarity with what's going on there, because it's really an attack on dissent. And it's an attack,
right?
Like, if you can't come out in opposition to government policy, then what's the point?
Just putting you on the spot quickly, are you planning on beating a pot and pan this evening?
I think I am. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Second, you know, I mean, this is, I hate to always come back to American politics, but that's where I am mentally. Did you see that, like, in Tampa, where the Republican convention is going to be in, I want to say, September, they're already, like, looking at how they can clamp down on protesting?
I did not see that. It doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, that's what happened in the last election in Chicago. You know, mass arrests, most of which were the charges were dropped.
Yeah, they're looking at that as that's where they want to start, where, you know, they did in Chicago, and they want to improve the efficiency of attacking the protesters.
Yeah, and then, you know, as I promised, I have to take a shot at the president here. You know, he has not, you know, he's moved to the right of Bush on the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, and, you know, and one of the big examples is there, for example, this documentary filmmaker, Laura Poitras, and I think I might have spoken about this once on the show, but she's been stopped over 36 times, never charged with anything, just coming back. She's an Emmy and Oscar nominated filmmaker. She did My Country, My Country and The Oath. So she goes to Afghanistan to make her documentary films, and Homeland Security stops her all the time and takes her computer, her phone, her notebook, her materials. She was told that she couldn't take notes with a pen because it could be used as a weapon. So a number of documentaries.
Which is kind of funny if you think about it, in the sense of, like, you know, writing, you know, the pen being mightier than the sword.
The
pen is a weapon, not in the eyeball sort of way, but just the documentation in and of itself. So they're right, actually.
Right. But it's this complete disregard of the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, that's what infuriates me around Obama's leadership on this, is that, you know, I thought, sure, he's the president of the United States. And as I said, you know, getting a progressive president is like asking a horse to knit a sweater. It's not going to happen. But you don't expect them to go even farther than what's been. It's like every year it gets worse and worse and worse. So I think these things are connected. You have these protests in, you know, in Quebec and now in Canada around this attack on civil rights. But where are the people in the streets arguing about their rights? People are not out in the streets in the U.S. and their rights are getting chipped and chipped and chipped away because they're trading what they view as security over freedom. And they haven't been so glaring about it. Most people don't know this is going on. It was a huge tactical error to do that in Quebec. Stupid.
Right. You know, again, 250,000 people came out in Quebec against this Bill 78 that was passed. And I don't think Quebec is not a big city. That's what I want to say.
Or Montreal, 250,000. Right?
Or Montreal is not a big city. 250,000 is a huge proportion of that population to be out in the streets.
Yeah,
I don't know where the population is, but it's not New York City. It's not Boston. It's not Louisville. Probably it is not that large. So 250,000 is significant. There's some pictures of it that I was able to find pretty quickly of just the amount of people walking the street. And apparently, as if I understood correctly, they purposefully, like, they did get a permit and then deviated from it.
Yeah, a number of people deviated from it. Yeah, in order to flout the law. Montreal is under 2 million people in it. So
okay. So you're looking at like 15% of the population of the city.
I mean, it depends. You know, yeah, it's incredible. And I think that, you know, they put a date on the law. They're like, it expires automatically after a year. But I can't imagine that it's not gonna.
Well, like the Bush tax cuts, things expire.
Yeah, they expire exactly. That's exactly it. That's a good point, Stephen, because that's the trick now. They're like, you think when they put those tax cuts in that they had any intention of them not being permanent?
No.
You know, it's very, very easy to. It's very hard to get back a right you've given up. There'll be another excuse or another thing. It's very, very hard to you give up that right, and boy, to get that back, it can be so tough. And I think that's the other thing. People see it as just, in a democracy, if you can't say what you think, and if you can't get together, and if you can't write or make a film, and all you can do is vote every 4 years, and, you know, your face 7-1, they were outspent in Wisconsin 7-1, because corporations can spend money now, then what's left?
Have you seen that there's a little bit of movement going now, Supreme Court-wise, against Citizens United? There's a very little slow movement beginning to, like, they're looking at that going, we might need to begin putting some limits on this, or that I'm willing to bet that within a year we'll have another case that chips away at that.
I might take that bet. I don't know. I'll have to think about that.
Okay, I'll send you the link that I was talking about.
All right. Well, maybe, Stephen, I think this has been our longest show of the year. Also, one of our two shows of the year.
I think we're at least three. But Matt, we're going to try to have a good summer and try to get at least two in a month for June, July, and August. Because I'm not leaving Munich. Well, okay, I'm leaving Munich, but I'm
okay, secret agent man. Who's
I'm here.
Whose partner speaks Russian and German? What size? Stephen is always traveling around the world. Under
Moscow,
Korea,
Seoul.
Under some pretense for work. He speaks multiple languages.
I told you
it was
South Korea anyway. Yeah, I told you it was South Korea.
Yeah, that's what you told me.
So.
Anyways.
Anyway, Matt, it was great getting back into the IRTN with you. I love seeing you and doing this again. It was great.
All right, well, and have a good one, and thank you to our listener. This is Matt Adams in Toronto, Ontario.
And Steve Benedetti in Munich, Germany, saying bye-bye.
Bye.